This is the Living Legacy Project interview with Jason D'Aquino on August 20th, 2013. So Jason, thank you for joining us today. To start our interview, I'd like to ask you, what inspired you to want to pursue a career as an artist?
My mother was an artist, and the earliest thing that I remember in connecting with my mother was asking her to create things for me and harassing her as only a child can do and saying, make this and draw that and paint this. And it was the closest thing that I knew to magic, which was just her with a wave of a pencil creating something from nothing. And I always wanted to do what it was that she did. And it was something that inspired wonder and interest isn't even a strong enough word because I became obsessed with it. In fact, recently I found some of the drawings I did when I was a child and I can't even tell what they were, but I'm sure at the time that they were just epically, phenomenally amazing. But yeah, I guess I wanted to do what it was that my mother did. And I sort of got lost in my own world and didn't have much interest in much else. So from an early stage, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. And no amount of logic or financial pursuit could dissuade me from the, according to my family, bad choice that I was about to make. So that's where I am, and that's where I've always been, pursuing that path in one way or another. And every job that I ever took or had to take was taken for the sort of benefits, not for the cash, but for the fringe benefits of, okay, if I take this job, then I'll be able to draw all day, or if I take this job, then I'll have access to books, and if I take that job, art supplies and studio, and it's always been like that.
So how old are you?
38.
Mm-hmm. And in your trajectory, have you ever pursued a degree in the arts?
I got my BFA, and then I got out. Mm-hmm. And I felt, and this is probably something that a lot of artists feel about any school that they attend, unless someone is just blown away by their university experience, and I've never met someone who was, but I felt like I took away from college what I took away. Not, there wasn't any wisdom imparted on me that I didn't seek out myself. And I have a problem with the university structure being that I think that the only teachers who are qualified to teach artists are visiting artists who are teaching. And I feel, and I hate to sound prejudiced about this or ignorant, especially if someone who's a teacher is listening to this, but I feel like if you're going to teach someone how to be an artist, you have to be an artist, not a teacher who harbors ill will toward your students and just feels like disdain that, you know, there are these young students who have a future ahead of them to pursue the path that I didn't pursue because I needed summers off and benefits, and now I'm a teacher and not an artist, and I don't have the time to pursue my own career, and it's a foregone conclusion that I'll always be a teacher, so I hate my students, and now I will take some sort of subtle anger out on them. And I could always sense it just below the surface. There were only a few teachers I had who I felt genuinely were imparting knowledge, and the rest were going through a rigid curriculum and wishing they weren't there and having some sort of subtle projected hate toward their students. And it was tangible enough for me to not like the university experience, and enough that I would like to teach at some point as a visiting artist to teach once I feel, and I probably never will feel this, it's part of my mental malady, but once I feel that I have enough wisdom to impart that it'll be worth their time. But I was always encouraged towards a teaching job. Every time I told anyone in my family that I wanted to be an artist, they said, well, yeah, you could be an art teacher. And they never got it out of their heads because that was the only thing that they knew of that involved a 9-to-5 and health benefits and a retirement package. And I could not possibly explain how awful that would be for me. And so I never pursued that. I don't want to sound overtly negative about the university experience or anything, but because I think it's great and you can take what you can from it. But I also think that when you graduate from high school, in the traditional path of growing up, you're told high school, college, homeownership, marriage, children, retirement. And I felt that I went to college because it was a chance to get away, far enough away so that I could pursue my own goals without having someone breathing down my neck. But also, I think that everyone should be required to take a year off after high school so that they can contemplate and understand, especially understand, the cost of what they're about to do, and not sign a piece of paper that says student loan, grant, and things of that nature that sound terrific and turn out to be crippling over the long term, just so that you can go to a school where you're going to acquire knowledge, which is supposedly power and totally is not power. It's simply an opportunity to cripple you directly from high school into an overwhelming debt that you'll be spending the rest of your life working off instead of actually pursuing the career that you intended to go to college to pursue, if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense, and actually it's very well said. And that's, in my head, I have a few ideal listeners that I'm imagining listening to these interviews, you know, and it's people who want to pursue careers in the arts, you know, and at different stages, and getting that perspective of some of the burdens that artists end up carrying as they do work within this capitalistic structure to try and do something that's ultimately very creative and doesn't adhere to the 9-to-5 structure that we're all told is what we're supposed to want.
It's been difficult for me to navigate, so I don't try to navigate in that sense, especially in the capitalist sense. I just try to get what it is that I need so that I can retreat and do what it is that I want. That's the whole story, you know? And I think that the part of my brain that's capable of formulating those type of plans and solving the riddle of financial stability is at some point going to be applied enough to get ahead and get over, because I consider anyone that spends a lot of money on certain things to be a mark. I have to get it out of my head. I don't buy art. I trade art. I trade art with artists that I respect and that I know, and I can't afford to buy art. So when I say that, there's a certain group of people that really appreciate the art and can afford it, and I love to have my work in their collections. But the 90% are people who have a lot of money and are going to spend it on something anyway, and you have to get them to spend it on you. And I hate that part, and I don't want to be the guy to sell it to them, but the money spends and it folds and it pays my rent.
I'd like to talk for a minute about how you went from maybe a disenchanting experience with a BFA program to being represented in New Orleans. Are you represented in other places?
I'm represented in Seattle with Kirsten Anderson of the Roque LaRue Gallery. I'm represented in New Orleans by the Red Truck Gallery. And there are other galleries that I show with frequently and have been welcomed back to show with, but not on a consistent basis.
Can you talk a little bit about some of your actions? Can you talk a little bit about some of the actions you took maybe during your BFA or your MFA career and then after your MFA career that led to the gallery representation that you have?
That's an interesting thing. And again, when you said earlier that when you speak, you're imagining a certain audience, like I'm imagining a certain audience for that question too. There was one class, which was an elective, which I don't even know if had credits attached to it, at the end of college where they had given out a sort of course trajectory, what to do now kind of thing, which was amazing that someone actually had this. And it was equally amazing that it wasn't a requirement, because it absolutely should be. And I was handed a list, photocopied, stapled list of entry-level not-for-profits galleries that were taking people directly out of college and giving them exhibition opportunities. One of them was Exit Art. That was one of the first places I showed after college. Great experience. Actually, my miniature work was put in a miniature space, which was between the gallery sort of bottlenecked. There was a hallway area that went to the cafeteria area, so it was narrower than the wider space, and they put my work along that wall because physically it fit there. What they didn't count on is that the bottleneck that it created of people caused traffic, and no one was able to get into the dining area, which was amazing. I was just like, oh, this is terrific. I just screwed up your whole flow. I just messed up your show, you know, and that was a good confidence boost. And I sold out the majority of that show. And then I was contacted by the intern who informed me that she sold all the work at wholesale price. And I was like, And she's like, technically, this is my mistake. And I'm like, yes, technically it is. And she's like, but I can't contact every buyer and expect them to pay twice as much for a piece that they've already signed on the dotted line to buy. I'm like, well, that's on you to figure out how you want to handle that. And she got the majority of them to actually pony up double, which was impressive. I really wouldn't have cared either way. It was a small kick in the pants, but I didn't. It wasn't the most important part. The most important part was already solidified in my brain of that event and what had happened and stuff like that. My confidence was built, and it couldn't be shattered by someone who was making clerical errors because they're flirting with a box boy or whatever. Exit art was excellent. There were venues that they listed, the Drawing Room in New York City, places like that. Because I went to college at State University in New York in Purchase, which is near Westchester. It's a great school. Video art, dance, film, that sort of thing. It was a good environment. It has a very bizarre campus, which is made almost entirely of bricks, which is really prison-like, but it's still a great school. But that one class was not, to me, enough, and I felt like the entire college was being trained in the arts with this sort of obtuse attitude, like it was the teachers knew that the whole time that you were just about to be kicked off a cliff, but they didn't care. And then they taught you everything you needed to know to be a fine artist, and then didn't tell you any inroads to becoming a fine artist, and then just said, goodbye, here's your diploma. You know, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. And you had no job opportunities lined up to actually pay you. So everyone became a bartender or a waiter or working for some regular, like, stiff 9-to-5. And the thing that saved me from that, aside from the exhibitions at the not-for-profit spaces, the entry-level places that they had listed in the one class, was becoming a tattooist. Because in my mind, show me a job where you don't... Even an illustrator requires an agent to get consistent work. And when you make an illustration, commissioned work for a client, they revise it over and over again, and you forward it to your agent. And then by the time it's completed... It's a messy process that has a lot of people in between you and your goal, whereas setting up a tattoo shop involves paying a rent. You open your doors and people come in daily with cash in hand to pay you to draw. And that's the best model for a working artist that I know of. I have never had anyone show me a situation where I could open a studio, put a sign on the front of the door, turn over the open sign, open the door, and people walk in off the sidewalk with money and hand it to you on the daily for drawing. Now, granted, it's a different tool to learn to use, but it's no more complicated than an airbrush. There are health and safety requirements that you have to go through, but pretty much any intelligent adult can figure those out. And if you have a good foundation in drawing, which you absolutely should before you become a tattooist, and that is another subject that sticks in my brain, that's a side note, but if you can do it, then it's the best entry-level job for an artist that exists for self-sustaining, self-starting, entrepreneurial, business owner, keeps you drawing, keeps you learning, and keeps you with heat and power. So, and the side note on the tattooing thing is, like, you can go into any number of restaurants and have the expected result of being served edible food. And if you go into a tattoo shop, that is not the case. Mm-hmm. These are not people who know, in general and across the board, how to create art. There's a huge majority of them who are either bikers whose friends have tattoos or sort of punk kids who like tattoos. And they think, for some reason, that it's a good idea. It's a cool job. You get to play music and wear clothes that you like and look however you feel and show up when you want to. But for some reason, they don't have that sort of moral compass or conscience that says, I should not be permanently doing something on someone that I'm not 100% confident is skilled and wonderful and to the best of my ability. And you ever see those artist tests that say, like, draw Tippy the Turtle, like that art school thing? I used to do that when I was a kid, and I was, you know, I thought it was cool and everything. Of course, you don't know as a child that every single person who submits it gets a response that says, you're amazing and you're accepted, and that, can I talk to your mom about trying to get a lot of money? And it's a great setup because they raise the child's hopes up, and then they go to the parent and ask them, give me some money or I'm going to crush your child, which is brilliant when you get into the capitalist end of it. But if they submitted that test to all the tattooists along with the health and safety standards, like, the tattooists would be able to study up on their, by the way, open book, cross-contamination and health and safety, open book. Worse than the learner's permit test. You can get two wrong, I think. So there you go with that. But if they gave Tippy the Turtle, half these guys would fail, which is amazing, you know. But anyways, the tattooing thing, yeah, great entry level for artists. Don't know any other job that exists that puts you directly in touch with your clients and a client base and keeps you drawing on the regular and gets you paid.
Can you talk a little bit about, so you touched on your tattoo work, but we actually haven't talked too much about what you create, what mediums or maybe what sized medium you work in. And then I'd like to touch on maybe the relationship between all three. But can you talk a little bit about the fine artwork you create?
I am primarily a miniaturist, and I work on found objects and old paper. The one thing that's been most recognizable for me that people know me for, if I can be so bold as to suggest that they do, because I'm even weirded out by this, like, hey, we want you to be a living legacy. I'm like, hey, sure. I don't okay, I'll do that. The matchbooks have been successful because as a miniaturist, I have found that people are viewing my work, especially now, primarily either in print or digital media instead of in personal experience. And if you don't personally see a piece of art, it somehow is a disconnect. It doesn't matter if you have your little label that says the dimensions on it. People don't even compute that. I mean, I could make that, you know, the whole size of the screen before you see the art, and people still won't notice it. And if you're encountering a piece of art in, let's say, a digital format, and you see it on a website or, you know, someone's blog, and you see the art, you don't know that it's a miniature. If it's a matchbook, when you scroll down toward the bottom of the drawing, you see the matches, which are universally recognizable size reference. So those pieces carry with them a universally recognizable size reference that tells the viewer, this is 1 inch tall, or 1 inch by 2 inches tall. And that has been the most successful tool, maybe, or that has been extremely successful format, I guess, for me. The reason that I work on old found paper is partially for a nostalgic sort of built-in history, because I find white paper to be incredibly sterile and unwelcoming, but also because when I started to work in sort of art-related jobs, I was finding that every job that I took, I had a lifespan of about a year to a year and a half before a computer program replaced me. So whether I was drawing stuff for centerpieces and daises at a child's party, or doing signs and advertising, or whatever it was I was doing, the boss eventually realized that even though they were underpaying me, they could underpay even more by acquiring a Photoshop or a sign maker or a print shop program that would do the job adequately, terribly, mind you, but adequately for less money. So they started replacing me with a program that would pump out garbage that the clients didn't know any better and would pay for, and they would make more money without expending the money to pay an artist. So my reaction to that technological takeover was to go even more caveman on it and just be like, I am going to reduce my art to a level where I can convince myself at some point that the only thing I'm selling is my ability. And I got down to not only a pencil and paper, which is like the least common denominator that I could think of, but a pencil and garbage paper. So I don't know where else I can go from there. I'm using stuff that has no value. Not only does it have no value, but people would just as soon throw it out as retain it. And then I'm putting a few hours and a couple cents worth of graphite onto it and selling it for, you know, $1,000 or whatever. And people are often daunted with the miniature. That's another subject altogether, trying to get someone to purchase a miniature when they look at the price tag and then they look, well, I can buy that painting over there. It's like 4 feet wide for the couch, you know, over the couch. Why would I buy this? It's like 1 inch tall. I'm like, you wouldn't, because you don't get it, and there's nothing I can say to you that'll make you get it, you know. But, the matchbooks, the found paper, there's a nostalgic quality to the matchbooks that I really like when we get into that sort of history, like where the object itself has its own history before you start, that especially because, again, the matchbooks are something that used to be handed out like candy. Like every restaurant or every bar would hand out a matchbook as their calling card. And now we have collectively become so litigious and ignorant that the idea of having a matchbook, it's a danger now. It's not something that a tool that's to be used carefully. It's something that's not to be handed out because the assumption is that everyone is stupid. So it's nostalgic for a time when things were a little bit, but when things were a little bit more Darwinian, if you will. Whereas if you set yourself on fire, it's going to burn. don't do that kind of thing. Like, rather than say, don't touch the stove, it's hot, everyone wants to take away the stove. And it's just silly. It's like, so the matchbooks represent a time, I guess, for me when everything was a little bit more innocent and at the same time trusting in the intelligence of people not to immolate themselves. So, but yeah, the matchbooks, the found paper. I also am heavily into collecting documents and antiques and stuff like that. And I think that I've hidden my sort of slight hoarding problem in my search for art supplies, so I can like make an excuse for myself when I want to acquire these things. I'm going to use that for art. So I have a huge collection of paper and matchbooks and old books and ledgers and documents and things like that that I'm going to repurpose into drawing surfaces. On a side note with that, and this is like kind of a weird story that may or may not be directly related to my art and my supplies and my medium, I have started collecting blank antique books. And the intention, I guess, was to illustrate a book as if it were a found object ledger, like the kind of thing that you would find in a horror movie, like someone digs up a ledger that was in some old cabin somewhere and it explains the story of someone who used to live there, that sort of thing. But the more of these sort of 19th century beautiful books I acquire, the harder it is for me to make a mark in one of them, because I'm just amazed by the notion that something that beautiful and that blank has survived unmolested for 100 or 200 years. The collection of antique books started early on but got a real explosive period because when I was in Kingston, I was living in Kingston, New York, near Woodstock. I was working at a tattoo shop on the Hudson, and I was about to quit working there because the working environment had become a little toxic, and I would always habitually go to this antique store on the corner just to browse around and see what I could find, and I picked up a stack of books that were each individually wrapped in plastic bags, and I started to open every plastic bag and look at each book individually, even though I was pretty sure they were all the same. After opening one that had been wrapped and covered in cloth by someone, and it was a math book, you know, Victorian age, I'm like, okay, whatever, I've seen a bunch of those. Then it was history, same size book wrapped in cloth, put it back in the bag. The next one, science, like, okay, I'm pretty sure what I know what I'm going to find. But when I got to the last two, they were handwritten books in quill pen that had been wrapped with the same covers but were clearly not the same thing. I purchased those books for $5 a piece, and one of them was a handwritten medical manuscript with cures for things like quimsy and dropsy. And some of the cures involved things like, one said, cut open the belly of cut open the underside of a white-bellied hop toad and apply it to the wound. Things like that. I'm like, okay. It was like some witch's brew of, like, you know, alchemical nonsense. And the other book was a handwritten whaling manuscript. And it was fully illustrated. It was by someone named Thomas Scoresby. And as it turned out, with a little bit of research and a little bit of intrigue with a rare book dealer who tried to screw me over on it, and the little things that happened in the interim, it made its way to Christie's auction house, and the hammer price on it was $16,000 for like a $5 book. That was a bad thing for a hoarder and collector of books to experience, because then I just started acquiring a lot more, and every once in a while I have to purge and pare down. But that book was that was pretty epic. I mean, with a little bit of research, it was like this guy was from a town called Whitby, England. Scoresby was mentioned by name in Moby Dick by Melville. In Whitby, England, there's a Scoresby Sound. There are like bodies of water and streets named after this man. In fact, the museum, the Scoresby Museum, contacted me early on when I was trying to place the book, and they were like, "We're very interested in your manuscript. Would you care to donate it to?" I'm like, "Yeah, yeah, okay, buddy. Like, here's the auction date. Why don't you bid on it? You know, if I want to donate it, I'll keep it." You know, but actually they didn't acquire it. There was initially a reserve of about 2,000 set on it, and two rich people whose names I don't know just went at each other and drove it up to 16,000. So that was good, because it paid for over a year of my living when I could just create a new body of work without having to pay my rent. Shows you what I do with my money when I get it. I retreat into my corner and I make stuff.
It's interesting, too. So I have been hired as the archivist here at the Birchfield Penny Art Center. So my relationship with old records is very different than yours is, but also maybe similar in some ways, kind of when you were talking about these blank books that you found and how you can't quite bring yourself to mark them. It's very interesting for me to look at your work and to look at the way you appropriate and create new things out of these old records, you know, in that way. And it's very liberating for me to look at your work because I'm able to remove myself from my normal concerns about records of that era.
As opposed to people in college who made comments at one of my shows along the lines of, why don't you try reading a book instead of destroying it? I was like, thank you.
I think it's that there are plenty of opportunities for historic records to come to archives and come to places.
But let's also make note of the fact that I am, as a collector and as an antique enthusiast, will not destroy something that has historical value to create a piece of art. That's not going to happen. I think the person who made that comment had ulterior motives and whatnot, but it's just me saying that you as an archivist are either going to feel great about my work or feel uncomfortable about it. Yeah. You know,
I feel uncomfortable but also distant, you know, in that you seem that you're handling this very responsibly, you know. I'm sure, and there's so
I'm
many...
also the type of person where if you said, oh my god, I can't believe you did that to that, I'd be, you know, I wish I had that, I'd be like, oh, I got another one.
And there's so many things, and also from an archival perspective, it's important to get away from this concept that we have to save everything, because not everything can be saved for archival purposes. You know, it's just not possible.
Right.
So it's like, sure, at least it's having a second life in this way. Though my one question is, how do you deal with acidification? Do you de-acidify?
I find de-acidification to be impossible.
Yeah.
And I think that the concept of archivally preserving a piece of art is a good concept, but it's something to be left to the archivists. It's not, I use all acid-free materials and UV-resistant glass, and I do everything that I can to prevent any of the work from changing color over time from exposure, but people need to understand that if you're going to have something, especially a drawing, and in addition, a drawing on a matchbook, you have to protect it. You have to not have it be in direct light, like anything else that's in direct bright light. I mean, anyone who buys art knows that you're not supposed to keep it in direct glaring light at all times, because it's going to affect it. Even if someone says that it's archival, you go ahead and wait and see.
Well, absolutely. I was even thinking more of like the old ledgers and old records that you use that was made before there was any concept of...
Well, the nice thing is that, like, usually when you get back that far, when you get past the pulp paper era of like the 40s and 50s, and you start getting fine linens and paper like that, it'll be around long after you are. It's the era of the cheap and quick that's going to decompose. That's why people have problems with things like baseball cards decomposing and whatnot. It's because that time period, this is not stuff that was made to last. This is like newsprint versus linen.
Can you talk about some of the different themes that have emerged in your art?
Well, a lot of the miniatures are, for me, just a challenge of recreating something intricate and something interesting to me as a personal challenge on a small scale in such a way that it can be blown up and still retain its detail and clarity. If it doesn't retain its detail and clarity when it's blown up, then it's a failure. And to me, it's like, it's not about how small I can go, because originally I was drawing smaller than postage stamps, and then it wasn't satisfying to me, and I brought it up to the level that it's at now. I've relaxed a bit with it, and I find it more satisfying because I know that what I create can be blown up and looked at on a large scale and still seem somewhat impressive. There are two different kinds of drawings that I do, and a lot of them have, they look almost like children's books that no child should read, like sort of evil, uncomfortable, unsettling illustrations involving children. And when I do that sort of cartoon allegorical illustration, it's because there are contents that I want to convey below the surface, and the reason that I use the children, it sort of weeds out the people who are casually observing the work, and I know who they are, and they reveal themselves because they go, you know, what is this? This is silly, or that's a little kid thing. And then someone else will look at it and be like, oh my god, I get it. I see what's going on here. I could use adult figures in there, but I think I'm perpetually interested with the idea of the warped children's book. Because I've seen artists sneak those sort of things into stores, and parents who aren't paying attention enough to even really care and are just going through the motions will purchase it for their child, and then they'll be outraged that they had been tricked when they really weren't paying attention to what they were feeding their children. And I'm just sort of obsessed with the sort of snarky malicious intent there, if you will, or just sort of it's more playful than that, but the illustrations that involve the children are all allegorical. There are stories there that are easy to follow and find if you're paying enough attention to do so. And the use of the children weeds out those that aren't.
Mm-hmm. I think in some ways it even makes it more clear that it's an allegorical narrative. And I will say that the children also have this more cartoony quality to them, mm-hmm, than your other work. And I think that also kind of maybe weeds some people out.
It does. It does. And there are certain galleries, like the gallery that I work with, the Red Truck Gallery in New Orleans, that lean more towards the fine arts representational miniatures and away from the allegorical childlike illustrations, whereas the other gallery, Roque LaRue in Seattle, is open to accepting either, both, or neither. And it's, I find it very unfulfilling to not be able to make those childlike illustrations. And when my schedule dictates that I have to create strictly representational, labor-intensive miniature work, I go nuts, and I find myself sketching like mad all these ideas, and then at a later time I come back to them and refine them and put them down. Now, the other thing that I'm grappling with, and a lot of artists grapple with this, is how they want the world to view them, or what sort of mediums and what sort of, when you get into like products, whether it's like books and things of that nature are respectable, coasters and visors and t-shirts, not so much, and it can get even worse from there. However, the cartoon imagery lends itself more to those sort of pop marketed products, and I want to get into doing them because it moves the imagery, even if people think that it's not respectable or it's silly, or you know, you're going to be viewed in somewhat of a kitschy light. That's fine, because the image is going to get out and around, and the people who recognize the allegorical meaning are still going to see it and be blown away, and everyone else can just wear it to the pool. I don't really care what they do with it, but I think it's a vehicle that I need to sort of research a little bit more before dismissing it. Despite the better judgment and advice that I've been given from gallerists, I just, you know, I like the idea. Maybe it's just a kid in me that says, I don't care, I want to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. You know?
It does seem that you are aware of the tension between accessible art and fine art in that way, in that, you know, that there is the art of the gallery and there is that perception of rarity that exists in the fine art world, where it does have to be held to this higher level. But at the same time, you want it to be accessible. You want it to be something, like you said, to get out there, mm-hmm, in that way.
Well, it's true. And also, like, I wish, the reason I like working with museums as opposed to galleries, and I haven't had a gallery show in Western New York, and I had a show at the Karpeles Manuscript Museum. And it's because there is a shared appreciation for what I was doing, and there wasn't the requirement to sell a certain amount of this stuff to make rent. And when there's a requirement and an impetus to sell a certain amount of the art you're showing in order to make your rent, the gallerist, who is very knowledgeable, now has to factor in something that has nothing at all to do with the art. So their opinion, while it is valuable, I still have to weed through it and figure out when they're being, I don't want to say honest, but when they're being committed to the notion of displaying what is worthy of display, and when they are factoring in which rich knucklehead is going to come in and buy this type of thing, and now I want to show this type of thing because I know it's going to sell, and that's when you get locked into doing something that's unfulfilling consistently because your gallerist knows that it's going to move and they want to pay their rent. So the museum show thing is terrific. I like keeping things simple enough that I don't have to figure out what someone's ulterior motive is when they're speaking to me. And in gallery shows, I would rather not ride the trend of what sells, but make what it is that I like and have that sell. And that's tricky sometimes.
That's very tricky. So kind of talking about some of the other themes in your work, I'm really glad you touched on the children and the allegorical quality, and also the gruesome violence to a lot of that imagery. But I think another thing that I've been thinking of since you started talking about the matchbooks and the the history of the matchbook and like this lost era. From a lot of the images I saw through your website, and also I did see the show at the Kripalis Manuscript Library. That was the first time I was exposed to your work, and it was phenomenal.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
But you seem to do a lot of like pulp fiction type covers on these matchbooks. And is there a relationship between like the era of...
It's totally. It's absolutely the era. It's because it's gritty, and it's become almost gritty, bygone, and noir, and those things are exactly that. And I love recreating that format. It has the same feeling to it as the surface conveys. And you picture the matchbook, you know, in a bar, and someone strikes a match to light a smoke, and you can see their face under the fedora, and there's the detective and the, you know, the bombshell and everything else. It just lends itself to that era. So I think I just sort of gravitated towards those. And then I got stuck in the everyone wants one phase where I have to make a whole bunch of them, you know. But I enjoy making them, so it's not really a thing. And they're, when I get into things that I don't enjoy making, that's when I have a problem.
So that leads me into another question. But first I want to ask, Chris, how long does it take you to create one of the matchbooks?
Usually, and I found this to be an effective way to work, I usually will work on 4 to 6 of them at a time. Because when I'm working on an old surface like that, it is not very forgiving. So there's not much room for erasing and starting over. And a lot of the matchbooks or the surfaces that I work on are specifically selected because they're, to me, individual and unique treasures. And I need to create this image on this particular thing because the image interplays and relates to the surface that I found. I got to be really careful not to damage the surface, because if I damage it, not only do I have to throw out the surface, but I have to throw out the idea because it's going to be dead and gone. So when you're working at that miniature scale with a pencil that's so sharp that if you rested it on your finger, it would go in to your skin and make you bleed, it's like you can actually flake up the surface of the paper as if you were scratching a pin on it. And with old surfaces, it's easy to do. So I have to very carefully and meticulously and slowly layer the hardnesses of lead, which hardnesses are darknesses, to create all the tonal values that I need. If I have one piece that I'm working on at a time, there's a tendency to overwork it. Whereas if I have 4 or 6 pieces to rotate, I will work just the necessary tone at this time and then rotate to the next one and work the necessary tone on that one and then rotate to the next one and then rotate through tones of lead until it is completed, when I finally use a very fine brush and a little bit of white undiluted watercolor or gouache to add the highlights. I've got to this method of working because I've failed to recognize the delicacy of several surfaces on pieces, and it's cripplingly disappointing and devastatingly crushing to have composed and worked out an entire idea and then have the surface be damaged after putting in 6 to 8 hours. And then when it starts to flake up, my mind goes, now, okay, I can proceed, and I want to proceed, and I want to complete this, but I know what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen. And as I continue to work, and then more damage is done to the surface, and I get to a point where in just a fit of fury, I either destroy it or I take it down to the local bar, get a beer, and throw it on the bar, and I don't care. Whoever finds the matchbook, cool. Probably some jerk who won't even know what it is, but I don't want to see it ever again anyway. So it's disappointing to destroy a surface. So I've sort of backed myself off and prevented myself from getting wrapped up in the sort of minutia of detail, and I rotate through several pieces at once so that it's more of a process and less of a direct one-on-one with each individual piece to the point where I destroy it.
Awesome. God, that's so intense. And also clearly the product of much painstaking effort.
Or just obsessive craziness.
Yeah,
one or the other.
Yeah.
If you want to make it deliberate, it's painstaking effort. If you want to make it sort of subconscious and undeliberate, then it's just a product of an insane mind.
How do you... you must be able to conceptualize what you want to render and how you want to scale it down very, very well at this point, to the point where, do you do much sketching beforehand when you start a work like that?
If it's something like a pulp or something like that that I have to reproduce, then what I essentially have to do is take a photocopy of the image, shrink it down to the exact size I'm going to do, and then a larger approximate size I'm going to do, one of which I'm going to view with my glasses on. I use high magnification goggles like jeweler's visors when I work. So one is at the size that it's going to be rendered. One is a larger one, just slightly larger, that I can see with the naked eye so that I can look at that. And also one of them is in full color to get a full tonal range, even though I'm not using tone. The color gives a more rounded indication of shade and highlight than the black and white does. Even if you have the best black and white, I find that to be true. And the only thing that I can do is do a basic map out of the piece. Now I can just sort of gently press down on the outline of some really roughed out shapes and then fill in the rest. And again, if the surfaces were new, if I was using white paper, I mean, I could transfer the whole thing and then just fill in the blanks. And it would just be like an exercise in drawing. It would still be not something that was simplistic to do, but there would be less room for error and it would be more mechanical. But at the scale I'm working with, the surfaces that I'm working, all I can do is do a rough map out and then fill in all the blanks, which is, you know, difficult, especially with portraiture. I just did a poster. I think it was one of the images I might have sent you. It was a poster from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So when it comes down to doing the actual portraiture, after all the details that are filled in, just the slightest little out-of-place fiber that lands in the wrong spot on the face that grabs a little graphite and it's wonky and it's screwed up and it's terrible and I'll have to toss it. So that's really difficult to hold your breath, which, by the way, I do, for long enough to create three portraits on a 1x2-inch surface and have them actually be recognizable. So that's why I like that piece, because it actually worked and I was convinced in the beginning that there's no fucking way this is going to work. I'm going to mess this up. This is definitely going to get messed up. You know, things like dragons are far more forgiving than portraits. And that comes back to tattooing as well. Like, you know, if someone, you're working on doing something and someone just all of a sudden moves or passes out or, you know, flitches or does whatever they want to do, you can say, well, that dragon's got another spike over there, or this, you know, his tail comes around here. You can't do that with someone's face. You know, it's either it's right or it's wrong. So in a way, tattooing stresses me out because you've got one shot. I mean, it's like doing your crosswords with a pen. You've got one shot. Not only do you have one shot, but you're not doing a drawing. You're creating a drawing while someone else is holding the paper and moving around as much as they can, and you're doing it in pen, you know, and then you're signing your name to it, and then they're showing everyone, look what so-and-so did. So it damn well better be good, and it damn well, you know, you better be prepared and you better be capable of handling all the possible problems that can and will arise, you know. So tattooing is more stressful than drawing for me. Also, there's the idea that tattooing, you're trying to satisfy the needs of each individual client. You don't just make what you want. You know, with sometimes my reaction to doing too much commission work and too much tattooing work is to make even more obnoxiously ridiculous stuff for the gallery shows that I have coming up, because I have people telling me what to do and how to do it, and I stay within the confines of what's going to make them happy. And I have illustration clients telling me what to do and how to do it, and I stay within the confines of what's going to get me paid. And then I have a gallery show coming up, and I say, I am going to make the most horribly, obnoxiously, ridiculously offensive thing that I can, and you're going to hang it, and some guy's going to buy it, because I can't stand these confines right now. So I'm deliberately making this as obnoxious and offensive as possible. And I can. You know, and that's the brilliance of the gallery show thing, and that's the brilliance of also bringing that element into my work, because it's a release of, like, the most perversely disturbing things that I can create and still have someone come in and buy it. I sold a sort of satanic portrait of Aleister Crowley to a lawyer in New York City, and he had no idea who it was, and it's on the wall of his office behind him when his clients come in to speak with him, which is amazingly funny that, like, he just liked the architectural layout and the image and stuff like that and the old paper and whatnot. He does not know who Aleister Crowley is and doesn't know that his clients who come into his desk and look over his shoulder while he's talking to them are staring at who was labeled the most evil man in the world. I just find that to be hysterical.
I think you should give a background of who Aleister Crowley is now.
Oh, I can't. I can't give a background of Aleister Crowley because I don't have my times and dates and my information.
Generally,
he was a mage, a wizard, a magician. He pioneered sex magic, where he was trying to actually tap into the most powerful mental energies and spiritual energies that people had, and he figured, you know, that sex was probably the most powerful time, and he worked that into, and he was also crazy philosopher and polygamist and what all religious types would consider terrible, and therefore let's give him the label of being satanic, but he was just a magician and someone who was not ashamed of human function to the point where he was integrating it into his belief system. And there are certain things that people don't like. And self-empowerment, people don't like self-empowerment, especially organized religion. They can't think of anything more evil than saying that you don't need Big Brother, that you don't need your, you know, Sky Daddy to help you, that you can do it yourself. So he was labeled as this evil, horrible person, but he was actually very smart. And if you can get past all of his perversions, there's a lot of knowledge he can impart. But he's someone that I was somewhat connected to for a period of my life that I'm not in anymore. But at that time, it amused me to no ends to think that some professional had that on his wall, and that anyone who happened to be a client who recognized who it was going to be freaked out to the point where they might not even hire him. And he had no idea what happened. I mean, do I have bad breath? Like, what happened?
On that vein, can you speak at all about people or artists you either know or saw imagery of at certain points in your life that influenced the scope of your work?
Well, earliest, which is, I guess, formative, would be, you know, my favorite children's illustrators, you know, Maurice Sendak and Edward Gorey and Wayne Anderson, who people might not necessarily recognize in the U.S. as much as they might recognize Sendak or Gorey. Wayne Anderson's meticulous fantasy illustrations were something that I was always obsessed with. And in fact, to the point where I curated a group drawing show a few years ago in New York City, and I invited him to participate and actually got him to send work to participate, which is amazing to me. He was also one of the most helpful illustrators that I've ever contacted, almost too helpful, to the point where when I asked his advice on becoming an illustrator, he said, don't, because he said that he looks at it the same way that I do, and it can be soul-crushing when you're using your own time, unpaid time, to try and create something that lives up to your own standards, and you're not being compensated for that because your clients don't recognize what those standards are. They just want a product, and they want it fast. They don't realize that this is something that's going to be around for a long time and representational of your work, and it needs to be amazing. And his work is amazing, despite the fact that he's selling it short because these jerks don't know what amazing is. So he's always been super impressive, one of my favorite illustrators. And so I guess my children's book illustrators as a child were things that urged me on a bit. And as far as what I said earlier about working artists, like, I don't mean to sound ignorant, but I am deliberately making myself ignorant because I don't want to see things that other working artists are doing and have it influence my trajectory of thought. And the worst thing that could happen, and this is one of the things that stopped me from looking, is to find someone who coincidentally was doing something that I had thought about doing, and I felt like I was robbed, and I wouldn't have been robbed had I not seen it. I would have pursued that idea to its fullest had I not seen that someone did something that I considered to be similar enough to abandon the project. So I don't like to see what other people are doing. I don't like to be influenced consciously or unconsciously by another artist's work. And as a result, I have to appear ignorant, and it's a necessary evil. It makes me feel stupid when I speak with other artists and they drop names that I don't know. You know, it's like when someone talks to you about movies, and you have that friend who sees every movie, right? The first conversation, he asks you about a movie, and you go, no, I haven't seen that. Second conversation, he asks you about a movie, you say, no, I haven't seen that. By the time the third conversation rolls around, you go, have you seen this? You go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he goes, remember that part where the... And you go, yeah. And then he goes, you didn't see it, did you? No. And it's like that with when people ask me about artists, because I don't like to continuously feel ignorant, but I'm not stupid. I'm deliberately ignorant because I don't want to be influenced, and I don't want to be discouraged from pursuing a certain path because I feel someone else has already been there. I would rather never know. But as far as working artists that I'm friends with, there are people who I really respect and people who I love to work with. There are artists in this region that I love to work with. Craig LaRotunda and Mike Morarian are two artists that I've worked and shown with before, and they're both incredible. There's an artist friend of mine, Robert Craig, who's completely underappreciated, and he's another example of someone where they have an artist in a gallery who's doing something similar enough that they can't show him because they don't want to slight the other artist, and it's terrible because Robert's work is immaculately genius, you know, and he, in fact, was one of the original artists who worked on Joe Camel for the Camel campaign. He's credited with that. So he was doing, you know, illustrative work and stuff like that. And eventually he just said, you know, to hell with this. You know, I want to make cool stuff and I want this to be super impressive. And it's so good that he has to add brush strokes to the work in order to convince people that it's not computer generated. And which is amazing. It's an amazingly ridiculous thing to have to do in a world where computers print out these glassy, glossy, perfect three-dimensional renderings that you have to go and add brush strokes so the knuckleheads know that you painted it. And they still don't believe them, which is actually an odd and remarkable detriment that you could do something so well that people don't believe that it's painted. He's an amazing artist. And I have a friend named Chris Conti, who's a sculptor that I love to work with, and we connect on many levels as far as like the antiques and like considerations and talking about the art world and whatnot and his meticulous nature. But those are friends who influence me more in companionship and attitude than in what I'm creating. I think the only artists that I could say that influenced me in what I'm creating were probably artists that I saw early on in formative years.
So this is kind of a hokey question, but I do like to ask it because I think everyone does have thoughts on it. Is there anything that you hope to achieve with your art externally to the larger community, whatever that community may be?
I think the only thing that I hope to achieve with my art, I look forward and I think, okay, well, you know, when I'm dead, someone's going to find this. And the only people that I want to find and discover my work after I'm dead and gone are children. Kids who have an interest in becoming artists. If I could feel that someone someday is going to find something unexpectedly and say, holy cow, I really love this, you got to see this, that would make me happy. Everything else doesn't really interest me. The themes that I put into my work are exercising my own demons. The subject matter that I choose are because I want to render them. As far as an overall, you know, larger message, the only pervasive theme that you'll find in my illustrative work is a sort of fall from grace, end of innocence kind of thing with the childlike figures. And I think that that is an echo of having been shocked out of childhood prematurely. And that sort of, when you look at the figures in my drawings that have that sort of blank stare, regardless of how happy they are, their happiness looks like madness. The smiles don't make the kids look like they're having a good time. It makes them look like they're insane. And then there's the sun in the sky in the background that's sort of happily watching over the whole scene. That's just like the witness to the event that's taking place. And it's a nightmare. It's a childhood nightmare. These are kids that are young and should be having fun, but instead they're living a nightmare because their whole world was completely fucked up. And that's what that is. And I'm not going to get too far into any of that or farther than I have. But that's not a theme that I'm trying to pass on. That's some sort of mental internal echo or cry for help kind of thing from a child who's still living inside my head, who's, you know, too old to be a child anymore, I guess.
Would you say that you use your art as a form of catharsis?
Oh, absolutely. I can't think of it any other way. I mean, when these themes and images and stories come up, I don't feel the need to create them because someone's going to buy them. I don't feel the overwhelming urge to make them because they're going to look cool. I feel the overwhelming urge to get them out. So it's definitely cathartic. It's definitely a message in a bottle. You know, there's something there that I need to do in order to feel okay. It's not like I need to do this because it'll be cool, you know. Which I hope it is, but it's kind of a side note, you know, secondary. I'd be doing it anyway. Which also was part of the whole, I guess, the part of my mind that actually does think about job and career and future planning says to me, like, stop wasting your time thinking about this, because even if you had a job when you retired, you'd be doing this. The only difference is that you'd be 25 years behind and working completely unsatisfying and wishing that you had used those years to get better. So when I quote-unquote retire, I'll be making the same work that I'm making now, so I'm not going to retire. I'll just continue to do this, and hopefully someone's buying it.
I think we touched on this already, but is there anything else you'd like to say about what you've done personally to advance your career in the arts?
It's just an odd question for me, like, because the only things I can think of are what have I done to deliberately be a detriment to my own advancement. So what have I done to be an advancement to my own career? I guess my career path itself involved graduating, applying to those non-for-profits, getting shows in that in the venues that I could, pursuing whatever clients I got from there who wanted to purchase work, and then getting the job at the tattoo shop in order to establish a studio so I could have income, so I could have time to create more art. I was approached by a few galleries after I had an online presence, which now is absolutely imperative and at the time wasn't imperative. But I think that online presence is extremely important because that's how, you know, early on it was like send out postcards. So I actually had to make and send out postcards, which luckily no one has to do anymore. The same way that most people will never have to have slides, they won't have to send out postcards. So my advice on that subject matter will be somewhat outdated and only, you know, good enough for a little bit of humor. But I was sending out all these postcards, got very little response to them that had, you know, amounted to shows, but I only had to get one or two to keep me going, so that was fine. I think getting into print and in magazines and stuff was very helpful, and the tattoo magazines and the tattoo exposure was a good inroad for the art exposure as well. Nowadays, I feel like the structure of the art world is changing with all of the art fairs, you know, Scope and Pulse and Red Dot and Art Market and Art Basel and all these things, Armory Week. I enjoy those events more than gallery shows. I think that if I can make a small body of work and go someplace fun for 4 days and sell it and party afterwards, it is better than making a large body of work and putting it in a gallery that's going to sell 85% of that work on the opening night, and then you have to wait a month until the show is done with a small trickling of sales after that, and then you have to eventually get paid, hopefully, because some of the gallerists seem to be so incredibly narcissistic and tyrannical that they don't even pay their artists and they think that it's okay and it's normal. And that's another reason why I don't want to get involved with more gallerists, because I've seen the worst of them, recently seen the worst that I've ever seen, and I don't want to keep exposing myself to that. So I'd rather work with the few that I trust that I mentioned than branch out to work with more. But the art fairs, I think, are incredibly important for artists who are emerging now to attempt to be involved in, because that is the new structure. Structures are changing, things are changing. Good example, I don't have an agent. I was offered representation by two agents, one of which is hugely high profile, and I rejected it on the notion that this is a person who wants 20% of everything that I do from now on, regardless of whether or not they made it happen, which is gross. And when you add the 20% for the person who didn't do the work to earn the 20%, you add that to the 50% that the gallery wants, and you've got nothing. And artists are being raped in a price sharing commission structure that is completely outmoded, completely outdated, and no longer beneficial to the artist. Before the internet, we needed an agent to bring together a client, a buyer, and an artist. Post-internet, the agent's job is to cock-block the artist and prevent them from ever meeting the client so that they can extort the money to make the connection happen. It's not a job. It should be illegal. There are levels of parasites that are beneficial, and then there are some that need to be shirked off. But the art fairs are a good... You know, get off the negativity right there. The art fairs are a good way to get into... booming sales market, high profile recognition, without having to book super far in advance and have the gallery rest its entire money making on your work. You get into a group, a small group by a gallery that's at one of these large fairs, huge traffic, 20 times, 100 times the traffic that you're going to get at your art opening. I don't care where your gallery is. And these are all people who've come nationally and internationally with money. So you want that capitalist end of it, the art fair is where to be. If you want the fun end of it, the art fair is still where to be, because there's less pressure, and especially if you go down to Art Basel in Miami in December, I can't imagine a Western New Yorker who doesn't want to spend a week, the first week in December in Miami. because even if you don't sell anything, you feel great because you're in Miami in December and everyone at home is shoveling snow and you're swimming at the beach. So that's something to look into. I can't imagine not. I've done it, what, 5 or 6 years running. I'll continue to do it. And on that note as well, the great thing about working with the gallery that I'm working with, the Red Truck Gallery, is that these guys have cornered the market on having fun and representing incredibly skilled, labor-intensive artwork. Noah Antio, who is the gallery director, his process of selecting work is based on unconventional medium and incredible skill and precision. Previous to working with Noah Antio at Red Truck, I worked at a gallery out of Luxembourg, and the gallery owner spoke French to the gallery director, who translated to me, and I spoke English to the gallery director, who translated to the gallery owner, and I had no idea whether or not my message was getting through or whether or not he was understanding what I was saying, despite the fact that he was smiling and nodding. And we moved a lot of work, but the difference between that experience, where I'm wearing a white shirt and tie and standing formally and speaking to someone who only speaks French, and sitting at the table at the Red Truck Gallery, drinking beer and playing cards with a giant and a midget in the middle of Art Basel, is something that I cannot even describe. Noah Antio is a former ball player who's 7 feet tall. Nick Reddy is, I'd say, about 3'9", and he's a performer who's living in Portland, Oregon. And these guys are the people that I work with, you know, including an artist named Brian Cunningham, who's amazingly talented, who's also from New Orleans. I don't know how he gets away with what he gets away with, but I do know that while the booth next door to us is displaying Asian art by hanging it in, surrounded by 20th century modern furniture and Eames chairs and Mies van der Rohe, someone handing out Perrier, we're right across from them spilling beer and making fart jokes and, you know, playing poker, and we're allowed to, and no one else is. And I think it's part of the New Orleans charm that they think it's performance art, and it's not. We're just just enjoying the shit out of what we're doing, and people gravitate to it, and I can't imagine ever showing with a stiff gallery again after that. It's not fulfilling to go from that to a formal setting. These guys are, and they're brilliant because they found a way to simultaneously have a good time and also be professional and intelligent with what they do. And it's, I would never show with anyone else in that setting. So yes, art fairs, would also choose your gallery wisely, because you want a gallerist and you want a gallery that likes your work, not just the potential for sales. I've heard a lot of artists tell me that some of their biggest shows were landed with galleries, and those prominent galleries later disclose that they don't like the work. It's just because it moves, you know. So I like the people I work with. I know they like me as well as what I do, you know. So we get along terrific, and the fairs are incredibly fun. I mean, Basel, Miami, for me, is better than Armory Week in New York, because I'm from Long Island originally. I went into New York City every weekend as a child when I wasn't supposed to. I walked the entire grid of the city. I'm perfectly familiar with Manhattan. I'm over it. I've always been over it. I like to visit there. I don't want to live there. Never have. But March in New York compared to Miami in December, March in New York is a brutal, dirty, slushy, nasty time filled with unhappy, bitter people who don't want to be there. And if they don't buy your work, then you get to stomp home in the slush to whatever hotel you got, and everyone's miserable. If it goes well and everyone likes everything and sales are made, then you compensate for that comparative misery. But when you're in Miami, it's vacation with the side bonus of possibly selling work.
So that leads me to another question, which is, what is your relationship to Western New York?
I was brought here because I was dating an artist in college who had family here, and they're still here, and they're great people. And there was sort of, we had a sort of support base here. Initially, after getting out of college in Westchester, we sort of bounced around a bit and went down to Long Island, came up with the idea of opening a tattoo shop after apprenticing in Kingston, and then had the choice to make where to go. And Western New York is awesome for entrepreneurs and self-starters and business people and artists, because you can afford to exist without killing yourself at a 9-to-5. So I was able to open up a tattoo shop here, or it was maybe 10 years ago now that we opened up the shop, paying a rent of $500, you know, as opposed to the Long Island $3,500 that would have gotten us the same square footage without any parking or anything of that nature. And if it, you know, first couple months, if it sank or swim, whatever, it's $1,000. It's not like the first and last of 7,000 on Long Island. Once you pay all the insurance and repairs and whatever red tape they throw up there, you're 10,000 in the hole before you open the door. And it's not encouraging to an entrepreneur who's not sure how things are going to play out. Whereas Western New York, if I decided tomorrow that I wanted to open just some random business, I'll open a record store. If it fails, it's a matter of the $500 rent or whatever it is. It's not a matter of sinking your entire savings and security into a project. You know, and I hate to see when small businesses fail up here. I hate to see it. But I also am not a retail dealer. I deal in a service, and I don't have to have stock and retail and, you know, back stock and ordering and all this stuff and then wait for people to come in and possibly buy it. You know, tattooists also do very well hourly. If you're good at what you do and you command a good price. Standard, I guess, in Western New York right now is around 100, 150 an hour. So when I'm working, that's what I get. I usually undercharge my clients because I am incredibly self-deprecating when it comes to my work, and I'll usually put in 3 hours for $200 or whatever, or because I know that it's not for them at this point, it's for me to make it as perfect as it can be. They'd be satisfied with what I'd already done, but this is my time and I want it, so I can't justify charging you for it. That's my mental block, I guess. I need to stop doing that. I need someone who can actually be between me and my clients to talk numbers, because I can't talk numbers. But tattooing pays well enough that you don't have to worry about going under, especially in a place like Western New York, if you want to open up a shop or a business. Not that I want to encourage all these people to open up tattoo shops, but I have no fear of competition, and I think that it's a good way to make money. And I've had a lot of artists ask me to apprentice them in tattooing, and the reason that I haven't is because I've never had someone come in whose work was so incredible that I really needed to do it, and God, I have to do it, and I just can't, you know. My problem, and I have artist friends who are terrific tattooists who are starting out, but is a huge problem that I need to overcome, is that I don't ever want to be anyone's boss. Mm-hmm. Because I want to tell, if I ever had people working for me, I want to tell them what they want to do, what they have to do on day one, and they're supposed to do it. And if they were to slack off and not do it, I would start taking up the slack myself rather than having the confrontation of telling them what to do, and over time I would finally get passive-aggressive and fire their asses. So I don't want to do that. I don't want to see myself as a boss. I don't want to be a boss. I don't want to be bent and twisted in different directions with the power of being a boss, so I'll never employ anyone. I just work for me.
Do you want to mention the name of your shop?
It's called Blind Dog Tattoo. When it was opened with artist Amanda Wacob, it was Blue Moon Tattoo. And then we worked with John Butcher, who's an amazing tattooist, and it was Leviathan Tattoo. And now I work with Rob Alsheimer, and it is Blind Dog Tattoo. The shop has changed names and business ownership and hands a few times. Right now, I just occupy a seat there, because after recent events, I felt like I wanted to just relax. You know, I don't own a house anymore. I rent a house. I don't own a shop anymore. I work at a chair, you know, because I don't want to have ties that I then have to maintain, or paperwork that I have to fill out, or things that occupy my mind that I don't want to occupy my mind. So right now it's easier for me to be that way.
What advice do you have for emerging artists? That we haven't already touched on.
Yeah, it's tough that we haven't already touched on. We touched on the art fairs, we touched on entering the art world in that aspect. As far as like developing your voice and like finding out what you want to make, it's very important not to copy what's out there and think that when you look at a cross-section of artists that you've been exposed to, the assumption is, oh, these are the things that I can do. Which one will I do? That's not the right answer. In the beginning, I truly believe it doesn't matter. Even if you are copying another artist in the beginning, fine, because by the time you're good enough to really enter the gallery world, you will have abandoned that, found your own voice, deviated enough to be an individual and improved to where that's just something regrettable in your past that you wish you hadn't done. And if you hadn't submitted it to a gallery yet, then nobody saw it anyway, and you can just sweep it under the rug. But a lot of emerging artists are copying existing artists who are still alive and working, and it creates an unnecessary tension and a problem. And it also doesn't serve you to do that, because you're always going to be seen as an imitator, and your efforts are going to go to bolster the originator. So don't do it. You know, make an effort towards not doing it. I found that when I was creating my work early on, it was getting too close to someone else, and I actually tried to encourage myself to deviate. He deviated, he went left, I went right, and luckily it worked out that way, because I would hate to be seen as imitating someone, and I realized that subconsciously I was, and that's why I got to the point where I don't expose myself. I don't want to expose myself. Expose myself to other artists' work. It's still funny. I can't get away from that. So don't be stupid and not educate yourself about artists if you feel that you need to, but don't allow them to influence what it is that you want to do. Just because they're making the stuff and it's selling does not mean that your stuff copied from their stuff is going to sell. It means this is what not to make. So I guess take a quick glance and jump in and then stop looking.
Well, Jason D'Aquino, thank you so much for coming in today for this Living Legacy Project interview. And we look forward to working with you closely in the future.
I look forward to that as well. Thank you.